Hi, welcome to Suits and Sandals podcast. This is Moses Chavi, your host, and today I have a wonderful guest whose name also is Guest. So, today I'm talking to Chris Guest. Welcome, Mr. Chris.
Thanks, Moses, and it's lovely to be with you today. And I must thank you for the lovely coffee, and really looking forward to chatting to you today.
My pleasure. So it's been long coming. I've been definitely looking forward to this interview, and I'm glad that you're finally here. And I enjoy your story, and I believe that our audience are going to be delighted to just listen to your background, who you are, and your plans and everything else. So just tell me, what's your background like when you talk about Chris Guest? Who is Chris Guest?
So thank you, Moses, and I guess it all starts in Kidderminster in England in the 1860s, where my roots are traced to, and the Guest family came out to Africa around 1860. You know, the first British settlement in South Africa was 1820, but I believe we were 1860s. Wow. On both my late dad and my mum's side. And so I guess I'm a seventh generation African, a white African.
Amazing.
And, I was born in a small town, really a one-horse town called East London. And East London is known for two things. Firstly, it's the kind of general area where Mandela came from, the Eastern Cape.
And awesome.
The Transkei area. You know, Mandela was born in a small village in the Transkei. And secondly, it's the world's biggest manufacturer of right-hand drive Mercedes-Benz.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
That's the two really important things to know about East London. It's a small port city. I guess population must be 300,000 people. So wow. A very small city, and with a long history, obviously named after London, as in East London. Yeah. So I was born and bred. My late dad was born there and died there, and very much Eastern Cape family. I was born in 1962. Please don't try and work out my age now. But born and bred, went to one school, boys' school, traditional school called Selborne College. Spent all 12 years at Selborne College, and then I proceeded to a university also in the Eastern Cape called Rhodes University, a very old British traditional university. And I did my Bachelor of Commerce in 1981.
Wow.
To 1984 when I graduated.
Makes me feel like a baby.
Yeah, I think you're just almost young enough to be my son, Moses, but be that as it may, I did my honors, and I did my articles after completing honors with KPMG, you know, the Big Four international firm.
Yep.
And while doing that, I completed my CA exams and became a chartered accountant in, I believe, 1991.
Wow.
So, stayed with KPMG for just on 3 years after articles, but I always felt the profession wasn't really for me. And I took up an offer with the South African Tax Office. Now, at that time, late 80s, so early 90s, actually, we had a compulsory conscription to the South African Army, but you had the choice of also, if you were a chartered accountant, working with the tax authority. So I joined SARS, South African Revenue Services.
Mm.
And I spent 5 years there as a tax officer, rising to a senior tax officer. So it was very interesting, good training.
Yeah.
And at that time, South Africa brought in VAT, but I was on the tax investigation side. We used to actually investigate taxpayers, and we would actually go to their premises, confiscate records, search their houses. So very interesting times, as you can imagine.
Wow.
And we succeeded in recovering a lot of tax. And it's quite interesting because a tax investigation can take up to 4, 5, 6 months, and you actually become quite friendly with the taxpayer, although you are purely there to enforce the law and fine him for his errant ways if he's found to be in contravention of the tax law and impose fines and penalties. Anyway, it was a good 5 years there, and I resigned in 1994 to take up a position with the East Cape Development Bank, so a development bank in the former Ciskei area, if you've heard of the Ciskei.
Yep.
It's one of the independent homelands prior to the Reformation in South Africa in 1994, when we had the first democratic election. So I took up a position as finance manager there. Very interesting. It was actually a development bank quite involved with the obviously development of properties and land within the Eastern Cape. So we were like a small loan kind of a bank, but on the development side, developing properties and loans for buying land. That was interesting. I was promoted to senior manager of finance there as well during my time. So going through to the late 1990s there, and ended up a senior manager of finance. And then I moved on to the audit side. So I basically trained as a chartered accountant, but I've been in audit and I've been in finance. And you'll hear as we progress, half the career spent in finance, half in audit, and now lately a new role, which we'll discuss in due course. But in the course of the time at People's Bank, it was a very good, or the Eastern Cape Development Bank, it was a very good learning curve. So we moved on to the Auditor General. And there I was responsible for auditing both local, provincial and national authorities in South Africa, national government. So very, very broad portfolio. The highlight there, I was selected for an international team.
Okay.
So interesting story. South Africa was awarded the audit of the United Nations, which is a big award.
That's big, obviously. Yeah.
And we had to kind of enter a kind of competitive process to identify the top audit managers, top audit seniors, and kind of come up with a national audit team. You know, we always said we were like the Springbok auditors, as in our rugby team.
Yeah. Rock star, definitely. That's a rock star team.
So we were the audit Bokke or Springboks, and we this was an excellent experience. So we were seconded on the assignment of the UN peacekeeping forces in the Western Sahara. So it's interesting. Western Sahara was annexed by Morocco. You might know this in the, I believe, mid-80s. And there was a short war, and then the UN came in. And by the time it was all peaceful. So the UN patrolled the kind of what they call the berm. It was like a line in the sand between the two sides. So it's obviously very much desert area, and the UN was patrolling it. So it was a kind of ceasefire, but hostilities hadn't ended, if you know what I mean.
So
we did the peacekeeping audit there. This would have been now the year 2000. And we spent a month there. Very interesting. So we took helicopters into the remote areas where the UN bases were. We audited the one Air Force base in Algeria as well. So very good experience.
I know it's fascinating, but sounds scary as well. I'd bet you'd think that you are going for a peacekeeping mission.
True, but as I say, it was perfectly peaceful, and probably the scariest part is sitting in the seat on the helicopter with an open door to get a good view. But we, you know, you sit with a harness around you. Very interesting. We landed in the desert did our stock counts and did our thing, and it was really a fantastic experience. But that wasn't the end of the UN assignment. The next place which they put me onto was the UN Development Aid Authority. So that's UNFPA, I believe, based in New York. So April 2001, I spent the whole month in New York. Interesting thing was I was on top of the Twin Towers in April 2001, which were to be part of course, the tragic events on 9/11 5 months later. So I was there just a short 5 months before. It's still, we have the photos on the top of the Twin Towers, you know. And this is a very interesting experience, but great experience again. So we spent a month in New York, fantastic experience. And of course, we got to do a lot of the tourist things as well, visit Central Park, go out to Statue of Liberty, and just had a great time. Greenwich Village, where the famous 60s folk stars performed.
So definitely, I know that you come fast forward to where we are now, but looking at your experience, like, it's a massive foundation. Like, within one career, if I take your career as one journey,
sure,
that is a massive experience to happen in one's lifetime.
Now, true, and we moved around a lot as well, as I say, you know, and I think that's been good. I'm probably a very well-rounded kind of skill set and knowledge base, you know, together with experience. So I went on to the Eastern Cape Gambling Board in year 2001. I remember it well because my second son had just been born. So interesting story of this. So I was auditing the Eastern Cape Gambling Board. I was the audit manager 3 years on the assignment. And one day the CEO called me into his office and he said, Chris, great audit again. And unfortunately, I've got some bad news for us, but it could be good news for you. So he said, our CFO just resigned, it was a lady, and he said, you know, how are you doing at the Auditor General? What are your future plans? So I said, yeah, well, we're always open to suggestions. So he asked me, he took a piece of paper out and he asked me to write my my present package on. I wrote it down, I couldn't work this out. So he looked at me, he says, we can offer you double that amount.
Wow.
Would you like the position? Yeah, he said, we're going to interview two or three candidates, but we'd like you to be part of the shortlist, and this is what we're offering.
Wow.
So I went for an interview, I think, the very next week, and within 10 days, I'd resigned from the Auditor General. Within 2 weeks, I'd started. So I became the Chief Financial Officer for the Eastern Cape Gambling and Betting Board. Very interesting times as well, because South Africa was opening up casino gambling. This was an incredible opportunity. So we were the regulators of the industry, of this fledgling industry, and we did a lot of international research. And being the top financial guy, they took me with the full board and the CEO and everyone, and we went and we researched primarily in Australia and Canada. We researched their model, visited their casinos, spoke to their regulators. So really a fascinating time, 2001 through 2006. So it was a good 5 years, and we really laid a good foundation. We awarded the first licenses in the Eastern Cape, three casinos, horse racing licenses we renewed. So horse racing had always been legal,
yep.
But they revamped the model. We had to renew the licenses, etc. And after exactly 6 years then, kids were getting a little older then, and we've always been open to international moves. So I sat in... actually in bed one Sunday morning reading the Sunday Times, which is our largest classified sections on the jobs, and found a job with the state audit in Abu Dhabi and applied for this. And within a few weeks they interviewed me, called me over to Abu Dhabi and offered me a job as director in the state audit office.
Wow, so the
happened
job,
like that.
It was advertised in a South African newspaper.
South African Sunday newspaper, exactly.
Do you think it's because South Africa is considered as a base for solid professionals in the domain of accounting, risk management, and all that?
I think so, yeah, indeed. I think the CA is widely regarded, South African CA is highly regarded.
Wow, quite interesting.
The quality of our universities and the training is very much highly regarded. So, in fact, I saw it one Sunday, I applied, and the next Sunday they called me again. So I thought, well, who calls you on a Sunday for an interview? I didn't realize that Middle East works Sunday in the GCC through to Thursdays. So they did a telephone interview. They did a second interview via video conference. And then the final one was in Abu Dhabi in 2007. And it was actually 8th of December, which is my birthday. So I had to miss my birthday with the family. And I was interviewed and made the final offer was made while I was there on the 8th of December.
Wow.
So I relocated. I remember the date. It was the 20th of January. I flew out from South Africa, leaving young family at home. Very sad about that, but I knew they would come in a few months. So we started in January 2008, and the kind of brief was to re-engineer the whole office and employ a lot more expats and kind of bring it from... a very antiquated, old-fashioned office into a modern, fully-fledged audit service provider. So
before you get into the deep stuff on the technical side of what you did in Abu Dhabi, if we think about the cultural transition, like you're coming from South Africa, pretty much that was your life, and you traveled around the world, yes, but there is a cultural dimension moving from South Africa coming to the Middle East.
Definitely.
Apart from the excitement, was there anything which we can call as a cultural shock, or what did you experience during that transition?
Definitely, a very important point, because I was a small town boy, one town, one school. My dad lived there. My dad went to the same school. My sons have started at the same school, so it was really a kind of cultural shock, but in a very positive way, because the big thing for us was, you know, looking at a very safe environment and a very much a kind of culture that respects the law. Mm. And it was fantastic. So, you know, getting used to the Sunday to Thursday working is not easy. You miss the people at home, but
true.
The good always outweighed the bad. I never look back, never regretted it, not for 1 minute.
Wow.
So, yes, certainly culture shocks, challenges. It's not plain sailing. It's quite difficult. And It was, it's all been a good experience. So the family came over in April, and you know, the initial indication was this would become a 3-year contract. But at the end of 2008, we had a serious downturn, the global downturn. 2008,
Everyone suffered that. Yeah.
It impacted UAE big time, United Arab Emirates. So
true.
Dubai, which of course you know, a lot of thousands of expats left, and the Abu Dhabi government, for which I worked, with the national UAE government based in Abu Dhabi. They kind of, intention to sign a 3-year contract never happened. And after 1 year, unfortunately, I was released with a lot of other expats. And actually it was a bit of a shock, and also not a very positive thing, because I had hired a lot of guys who had families and we were kind of, most of us, I think 95% were released. They might have kept one or two on, but at lower levels. So all the directors, managers, team leads were released.
Oh, man.
Anyway, God provided, as he always does.
Yeah, true.
Within 6 weeks, a job came up with in a country called Qatar. Now, I'd never heard of Qatar. I'd heard of Qatar Airways, of course. Everyone knows their advertising, but I'd never heard of Qatar. But it's just 45 minutes from the UAE, as you know. And we flew over again, had an interview in late April 2009, mid-April. And again, it all went well. I had the offer, and I started in May 2009. And again, the ever-loving wife and family followed. Kids had to uproot school again after a year. But again, it was, you know, by then I was used to the GCC, and Qatar was a good experience. And it was to be proved to be the longest position I've ever held. So I was appointed in an oil and gas company, Qatar Gas. So as you would know, it's the world's largest producer of liquid natural gas, exporting to over 30 countries with an end-to-end supply chain.
That's
including
massive.
A fleet of more than 40 ships. Yeah,
massive enterprise.
And I'll never forget the advert. It says, do you want to be something? It said in the newspaper, do you want to be part of something big?
Wow.
That's what caught my eye, the in the smalls, you know.
You're like, yes, definitely, I want to come.
It was in the smalls, but it was a large headline.
Oh,
so it all happened within 3 weeks, and it was very quick, and I got there. Visas issued, as you know, the process, the family can only come once your visa's issued. It took another month, and the family were there by July, and it proved to be a very, very good career. I started off as a what you call a control specialist, and the indication was given to me on day one, you will take over as head of department when the seconded resource, so Qatar Gas has a lot of seconded resource from its partners, ExxonMobil, Shell, other major players in the IOCs, international oil companies, and I was given a very clear brief: you just prove yourself, and you'll be head within a year to 18 months. And sure enough, after about 18 months, I think 2 years, I became head of department, built up a small team there, and we looked after controls, risk controls, and compliance for Qatar Gas. So great experience building it up from greenfields, kind of embedding a controls culture. One of my KPIs was to bring down audit queries, Moses, which might interest you. We managed to slash the audit queries by 80%. Manage the internal issues, build up an issues database, monitor it, close the action gaps, report back to management, partner with internal audit, provide a one-stop shop for reporting back on the follow-ups. So it was really good. And then on the integration of Qatar Gas and its affiliate RAS Gas, which you've heard of, in 2018 was actually promoted again and given the tax portfolio. So I became head of controls, risk, and tax. So a big portfolio.
That's massive.
Six people reporting. And it was a good run, you know, it was a very good run. Had some tough times when the oil price tanked, oil price went down, and things were tough. But it was a very good run, 11 and a half years. And unfortunately, during COVID downturn, I was released. But again, as always, God provided.
Yeah, never always a way.
Never fails you, and the door always opens. So within 2 months again, I joined a company called Mosalat.
Beautiful.
And it's been a good experience. I've been there 15 months now, head of risk and compliance manager. So again, a greenfield startup, and I've done three of those by now, so it's kind of, greenfields should be my second name, really.
Now, before you go into any deeper stuff, like just looking again at the turbulence. So you've had highs, you've had lows.
Indeed.
But if you look at someone who's planning to make an international move, to shift from a home base and get to become an expat or expatriate, most people get afraid of exactly what you've just explained. Like for you, definitely, it looks like when you get down, you end up getting something better or something far much stable, But you also get into domains where you're exposed to massive things, massive experiences. Mm. But someone would say, I don't leave my home, and end up being told that you are let go. Like, what am I going to do with my family? I have family plans. I have investment plans. I should have been something back home. I took a risk, and now I'm in a foreign land, and I'm told to go. Like, how do you balance the fear factor, the risk factor, and the benefit factor? Like, what has been your experience, and what would be your advice?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting what you're saying, because I always look at the upside. So I'm kind of from the risk discipline. So I always say, what's the risk of not taking enough risk? So
interesting. Yeah,
you need to take enough risk. Yeah, I always see. I think I'm a natural optimist, although I have my downers as well. But I'm a natural optimist and always look at the upside and always remain positive. And I think I built a lot of resilience. So my advice would be, come in with your eyes open, learn as much about the culture as you can. Mm. I didn't do that, so it's always wise to know as much about the culture. So you're taking a calculated risk. But you know, be open to the upside that you're likely to experience as well. So always be positive on it. And I think the other thing, the key thing, so financially, in the GCC context, never get into debt. Don't ever get into debt. Buy your cars for cash. Live within your means, like my late dad, may he rest in peace, always said, live within your means. Cash is king. Use a credit card. Use it wisely. Pay it off each month. But I think I learned one lesson in Abu Dhabi. I bought new cars when I arrived, and I had to leave after a year, and I took a massive haircut, can I say. So you need to live within your means. Yeah. Embrace the culture, network as much as you can, get to know the people. And you know, after 13 years in Qatar now, I feel like I'm almost it's definitely a second home, you know. So getting back to Mosalot, it's been a really good experience building up their culture again. The World Cup 2022 is our major challenge and our major risk, and it's really exciting growth period. So hope to have a good few more years in the Middle East, if God is willing.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much for the interview.
Yeah, but I wouldn't let you go, because like there aren't many days when you sit with someone who's so experienced, who has practical exposure in different fields, and
lots of gray hairs.
Because these days, as young people, basically, of course I'm older than that, but people get excited and they don't really understand issues of vision and issues of purpose, issues of influence, issues of personal development and influence in the workplace, because we need people like you to get into spaces like universities and just to lecture people on what is life all about. When you move out of university, for example, what type of world are you going to face?
I mean, coming into the real world, yeah.
Exactly.
So very interesting. One of the highlights, and I may have omitted to mention this, is that I've trained more than 25 GCC nationals, both Emiratis and Qataris, and that's really rewarding. More on the job training, not so much university, more on the job training, going through independent development plans, what we call IDPs. So in the oil and gas, we move people around and train them. And I think that's really rewarding, you know, transferring the skills. Because in the GCC, we're all here actually to work ourselves out of a job and to create the skills in the long term, you know.
True.
So I think that's really rewarding. I think young people need to be practical. They need to realize that it's tough in the real world. It's not easy. You can't live your life online. You need to get into real world face-to-face interactions.
Yeah.
As you know, I still prefer face-to-face meetings to Zoom sessions and other stuff. And the technology, which those of my generation aren't really up with. I mean, I know there's a place for that, and COVID's done a wonderful thing, and it's great to be online, but I always prefer the face-to-face interaction. Nothing beats looking someone in the eye.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think that's what I would say. Have a varied career, get out of your country, see the world, do as much as you can and embrace it. The only regret I have is that I didn't do it in my mid-30s instead of my mid-40s.
Yeah, beautiful. And one of my very last questions, because if you give me a chance, I'll talk to you forever. So my last question would be, again, you touched on debt as one of the big detriments to stability in a foreign land, but it's beyond just being an expat. Even people who have not even traveled outside their home, they would have issues to do with personal debt and they fail to develop. But beyond that, since you are more like a professor now, we joked the other time that we should all, like at your age, you always say I'm 50 plus. You don't really get to court the actual age. So for as someone who's in their 50 plus, when it comes to living wisely, for someone who's in their 20s, right? You've touched on very important tangents. But if it there has to be a take home advice, what are the top five advices or types of advice that you'd give a 20-year-old? Just five.
20-year-old is that I think the main thing is go to university, study what you think you should, but your career will change many times. You won't end up where you thought you would end up. There's no way. You need to reinvent yourself. Clear. So that's probably one and two. Study what you put your mind to, what you think you should do. Secondly, keep on reinventing.
Awesome.
Thirdly, live within your means. I've mentioned that already.
Beautiful.
Fourthly, leave your comfort zone. Get international experience. You might come home and bring it back to your country, but get that international experience.
Crucial.
Number five, I think just have fun while doing it.
Yeah.
Always put your God and your family first.
Awesome.
Most important of all.
Awesome. Chris Guest, thank you so much for giving me all this special time and for providing content that's of top quality to our audience.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time and wish you every success in your ongoing podcast and your ongoing entrepreneurial efforts in general. Thank you so much and good night.
Good night.